Aaron Clark, who died this last weekend over at, she was 80 years old, but Karen Clark was one of the people who bubbled up out of the movement for change of the 1960s. And she finally came out as a lesbian, and she went and got elected to the state of Minnesota legislature in 1980 and served 19 terms. And she helped pass legislation that would pave the way for the legal representation of gays and lesbians. It was signed by Mark Dayton, someone I knew. And Karen was a friend, a neighbor, and someone that I've known many, many years. So, Dave, you have quite a history with her also.
Yeah, thanks, Don. Speaking of the 60s, Karen Clark and my sister Ruth Ann, who sadly died in 1972, were very close friends and among the founders of the women's health movements, and they were both RNs and helped with clinics and women's groups and so on. And so it was a family friend, Karen Clark was, for many, many years. Then I didn't see her for quite a while, and later resumed a little bit of my love for apple picking by helping at the Women's Environmental Institute up by North Branch, where Karen Clark was co-director, and her partner Jackie sadly is without Karen. And so for several years, I got to see Karen a lot and work in the orchard, so both of them were extremely satisfying for me. She was a community hero, for sure.
She was a stalwart in pushing and getting acceptance for gays and lesbians, as well as myriads of other legislative attainments. Oh, Dave, what have you come across this week?
Well, again, I'm thinking of Northern Sun News as news beyond the mainstream. So some of the ideas and voices will be familiar and some of them won't. And we're covering a lot of ground today. As usual, I've got too much ground to cover, but let's just jump right into it. It's going to be a lot about the situation in Iran and Israel and touching on some of the serious implications for the economy and commodities as well. The forced pause in the Strait of Hormuz remains largely in place despite initial crossfires, but Israel continues its assault on Lebanon, which prevents any lasting settlement. Iran, unlike all the Arab nations, is resolutely defending those resisting the Israeli aggression in Palestine and Lebanon, and has relief for southern Lebanon at the top of the proposed agreement. Meanwhile, the Strait of Hormuz traffic continues to be greatly restricted, though in one new development, Oman has engaged in discussions about joint Iran-Oman monitoring of the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran had proposed earlier, wanting fees to be mandatory, Oman saying they should be voluntary. Today, we'll cover the war in Iran, providing some background on the current high-stakes mess. That will include events in Israel, in Iran, and the U.S. The U.S. is quietly withdrawing troops and personnel in West Asia, it appears, despite the ongoing bluster and bombast for media consumption. There is disagreement among the sources of today's commentary on whether a resumption of escalated war is likely or unlikely. Finally, return to the topic of propaganda, ubiquitous in today's world, a discussion aimed at helping listeners recognize it. Examples? The incessant litany renewed each year on the Ukraine war of Russian failure, Russian retreat, internal rebellion in Russia, and Putin weakness. All fake, all to keep the war machine fueled and the public misled, while Russia continues its gains on the battlefront. In fact, Zelensky is the captain of a sinking ship, determined to stay the fatal course. European leaders, meanwhile, preach war and rumors of war, sponsoring drone attacks inside Russia and funding and arming the Ukraine kleptocratic regime. Some of the arms have wound up in Mexico and South America. Here's a reminder of the stakes. This is a brief couple minutes or so from Professor Steve Keen, who is kind of a maverick economist in Australia, and with some examples of the impact on commodity trade.
This is out of it. And without the helium, then the supply of microchips will stop. Without the helium, you won't be able to do MRIs. Without the helium, you have the whole range of monitoring systems you need for advanced production processes, which can't occur. Now, about 30% of the world's helium passes through the Strait of Hormuz. So that is gone. Sulfuric acid. We think about sulfuric acid, if we ever do, just as, you know, something we use at a, you know, one experiment to see what sulfuric acid can do to dropping a coin into the sulfuric acid at an experiment at high school. But without sulfuric acid, we can't refine copper. Copper is absolutely critical for transmitting electrical power. It's critical for making data centers. It's critical for it's critical for an enormous range of production processes that we all depend upon. We're not aware of it. Suddenly, because hydrogen sulfide is a side effect of mining oil, then that is where the sulfuric acid is created, and that sulfuric acid passes through the Strait of Hormuz. The production processes that depend upon sulfuric acid are not going to have the supplies anymore, and once their stocks run out, the goods and services that need sulfuric acid as a production input can no longer be made. So we are going to realize just how fragile our system is, courtesy of this crisis. And it points out that, again, the war was completely unjustified. Iranians were not building a nuclear weapon. In fact, their leader, the very first person the Americans killed, had put a fatwa against creating nuclear weapons. So it's a farcical, unjustified war. But what it's doing is not just damaging Iran, it's damaging the production systems of the entire planet. So when we bombed Iran and led Iran to make the sensible decision as a military strategy of blocking the Strait of Hormuz, we damaged ourselves. So effectively, we're shooting ourselves in both feet. That's what we've done. We sort of treat each element of the planet as isolated from every other element and think we can do something in Iran and not worry about the consequences in the rest of the world. Effectively, we're blown our own feet off. We now find we've got to crawl rather than walk. Oh, that's...
So there again was Professor Steve Keen, with some reminders of the implications of the disruption of the commodity trade, not just oil, but a whole bunch of other things, and helps, again, explain some of the significant leverage Iran has in the war and in the situation. Reminders of recent history here. People already forgot that 1 year ago, Israel and U.S. lost the 12-day war after their attack on Iran because Iran's military capacity and civil resistance proved superior. Unknown to many, it was Israel and the U.S. who asked for a pause last year. U.S. rail used the following month to prepare for the next attack on February 28th of this year, and the outcome was further damage to U.S. and Israel and Iran control of the Strait of Hormuz. But now the U.S. refuses to exercise its power and ability to restrain Israel in Gaza and West Bank and Lebanon. Israel violations of the Memorandum of Understanding and its killing and destruction in Lebanon have only partially lessened. So, Rubio and the U.S. betrayed the Memorandum of Understanding in Lebanon. A weak Lebanon government surrendered to Israel. Legal claims, get this, against Israel have been abandoned by Lebanon. There's a parallel happening in the U.S. We'll come to that in a minute. But Hezbollah is a very large civic and political part of Lebanese society, not to be destroyed despite Israel's genocidal intent. The Memorandum of Understanding is a pause. It is not peace. Trump and crew have shown no willingness to stop Israel's Lebanon attacks. Meanwhile, the U.S. thinks it can, quote, restock on oil, as just stated by Vice President Vance, a superficial strategy given other constraints. Here we have, for the umpteenth time, in Ukraine and in the Mideast, the U.S. using the pretext of negotiations to prepare for more war, even to assassinate the negotiators. Now I have a little clip from Professor Richard Wolff about the larger global situation. Let me see if I got the right... Here we go. And he's on the Danny Hifong show. Danny's in Southeast Asia. Has a lot of great interviews and commentary. Here's Professor Richard Wolff.
An eastward shift, it seems like, of both economic and military power. How does this factor into the impact and the shocks to the especially the U.S. economy, built on, as you just said, these ultra-rich individuals, these monopolies, these corporations that are looking at this, I think, in a very concerning manner, and therefore are very much willing to, they all do it, invest in the mechanisms of war, for example, like the military-industrial complex. They all do it. All the majors, they all have major investments in the military-industrial complex, meaning that they're obviously both wanting, as you said, to profit from this and also want to see the escalations work out in their favor. But how is that going to go, and how is that going, I guess I should ask?
Well, I am afraid that what I have to tell you will be a little bit depressing. On the other hand, if you don't want to hear what's really going on, you can always turn on the television or the radio here in the United States, and you'll hear a different story, and it'll be very comforting, and everything will sound like it's under control in a perfectly reasonable way. And I'm going to assure you, it is not. And let me do it as follows. There is, at this point, as you put it, a shift to the east, to Asia. And what that means is that the United States, which for most of the last century was kind of the model, it was where everybody, I mean, I'm exaggerating, but they get the idea, where people were comfortable, where everybody had a house, and everybody has a car, and everybody can go on vacation, and everybody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The model to be replicated, to be copied, to be envied, all of that. Everybody learned to wear jeans, everybody, et cetera, et cetera. The latest gimmick from Silicon Valley was the kind of telephone you had to have, or the kind of Wi-Fi you had to use, on and on. All of that is fading away. China is matching the United States gimmick by gimmick, including everything in AI, everything in agent AI, all the latest bells and whistles. The Chinese are matching or doing better. And there's no end of that. And it's going to get worse, not better. It's going to become more and more the Chinese, and we're going to be the catch-up, because they've already caught up. And the whole world sees it. And as the gap between rich and poor happened, and let me stress that too, one of the things every declining empire shows is that when the empire declines, the people who are rich and powerful in it are in the best position to hold on to their high standards of living. That's what we're watching with the top 10% playing with the stock market. They're holding on to their great wealth. But that means the costs of decline, who's going to bear them? And the answer is you, who can't afford your home anymore. You, who can't afford to go to college with at all or without loading up on a level of debt you won't retire for the rest of your life. The signs of it are everywhere. If you just look, But that's the problem. We're not at the point yet of looking. We're still at the point in this country, in the United States, of denial. It's a psychological syndrome in which something that frightens you is handled not by coming up with an understanding, not by coming up with a strategy. No, no, no. By simply saying, it isn't there. By insisting, what do you talk about decline? Look at the stock market. It's going up. Absolutely. It's going up. It has got nothing to do with nothing. I've explained to you why that happens. It's a symptom of a society that's completely out of whack.
There again, Professor Richard Wolff. He's in Amherst, Mass, in New York City area, and he was being interviewed on the Danny Haifong program. So I have some more commentary to read. This time it's from Eve Smith at nakedcapitalism.com, one of my favorite websites. And there's some important comments here, so I'm going to read a couple paragraphs and maybe discuss it a little further and call on Don if Don has any reaction. Here's what she said just a day or two ago about the Iran war. So despite Iran scoring a PR win by blowing off the truly dreadful Kushner-Witkoff tag team, it still does not have any of its frozen funds. Remember, there's many billions frozen by the West in Iran funds, and one of the points in the Memorandum of Understanding is immediate return of some of those funds. Well, so far they still don't have any. Recall that Iran had earlier attempted to have the U.S. return some as a condition of entering into the Memorandum of Understanding. So aside from the U.S. ending the blockade and giving Iran oil sanctions relief so it can sell its oil without hassles, which have largely happened, Iran seems to be nowhere on getting the U.S. to honor the MOU. Bans is bragging that the Memorandum of Understanding was merely a device intended to bring Iran to heel and that it did not work. And if it did not work, it would still buy time for the U.S. to restock its oil supplies and weapons. You catch that? That's what I was saying earlier, that we use these negotiations as a way to build up for more war. And Vance just said so. I saw it a day or two ago. Another one, and here I want to make sure people understand what the Minsk deal is. Minsk is in Belarus and was the site of agreement after the 2022 Russian invasion. I'm sorry, after the 2014 war in the East, and Germany and France were co-signers and later admitted that, again, same pattern, that they used 8 years between 2014 and 22 to build up for war, to bombard the eastern Ukrainian provinces, and turn it into a NATO proxy. So that's the Minsk deal, which ended up being betraying Russia by the West. You know, the terms were not fulfilled. So back to Eve Smith. I confess that I had not wanted to believe Alexander Mercouris, that Russian officials told him that they were concerned that Iran had fallen for a Minsk-type deal, intended simply to buy time so that they could have another go. As we will describe below, the U.S. is complying with the MOU only in areas that advance its interest, which here is to allow Iranian oil to go unfettered to buyers to calm the oil market. It is not hard to imagine that the U.S. planned to extend it beyond 60 days. One more short paragraph. Oman and Iran are trying to agree on a Strait of Hormuz scheme, but are still at odds on whether payments are obligatory. Mandatory payments would violate the Law of the Seas Agreement and would open up Oman to international criminal justice lawsuits if it participated. Don, anything?
Well, it is so interesting how U.S. relations with Iran, twice when they've had negotiations over the last couple of years, June of last year and more recently this year, at the very time that they were having these negotiations, the U.S. and Israel launched war on Iran. This is just a pattern that makes the Iranians think, well, what can we believe? We were negotiating, and all of a sudden, here we have...
Competitive is the reason.
Sorry. Go ahead, Don.
We have terrific bombardments coming from all these jets flying over their land and the trying to kill as many of the senior leadership as possible. So Iran is wise to be wary of whatever is on there. That's why it's been so necessary for Iran to counteract what the U.S. is saying in this memo of understanding, which has been agreed to, and exactly what it is. And Iran says, this is what we're doing. This is how we're obeying that. And so it's something to keep in your mind and to listen carefully to, hopefully you'll find out what is also going on beyond what the pronouncements are from the U.S. Establishment.
All right. Thanks, Don. Now we have Colonel Douglas McGregor. We've heard from him before. A couple brief clips. He's being interviewed on the Professor Glenn Deason show. Again, sticking with the Iran-Israel conflict here. Hold on while I get to the right spot.
Business from the Napoleonic Wars returned with a vengeance by 1914, 15, and then burst into the open in 1918. So I think that your assessment is accurate. It's profound change. It's not necessarily in the direction that we in the West would like, particularly the United States, but it's going to happen anyway. And the smart thing would be for the United States to accommodate it. You know, in this sense, Britain was very stupid in the first part of the 20th century. It could have accommodated the rise of German influence and power without any difficulty at all. Instead, Britain's refusal to accommodate Germany led to an inevitable war that destroyed almost everybody in Europe. So there's not much evidence out there for common sense and, let's put it this way, tolerance for anything. That's depressing. Now, is there any good news? Yes. The difference is that we are really financially extraordinarily leveraged and, as a result, very fragile. This almost never seems to come up for discussion, Glenn. You know, when someone like you says, well, it looks like we're going to go to war with Russia. Well, that's absurd. There's not going to be any war with Russia. The Europeans can't fight. They don't have anything. They're leveraged up to the hilt. They're in very fragile condition. They're dealing with an electricity bill that is beyond anybody's imagination. The French are the only ones that are not suffering dearly under price hikes in electricity because they're so heavily dependent on nuclear power. But Germany and Italy and other countries are really suffering. German industry without reasonably priced energy, which is certainly not what we're charging the Germans when it comes to liquefied natural gas, has really hurt Germany tremendously. Germany is no longer competitive as a result of the loss of cheap energy. So you look at an enormous firm like VW, which is an institution in Germany, they're shutting down plants left and right. And surprise, surprise, there's tremendous unrest in Germany. Now you add to all of those problems the presence of millions and millions of unwanted non-Europeans. Most of them are Muslims, but not all of them. And the populations in Europe are very, very restless. They want a return to a better way of life. They want peace at home. They want a reduction in criminality, and they don't support war with Russia. So how do you get there from here? Well, the last word in this sort of thing is revolution. And you're going to have something akin to a revolution, whether it's a revolution at the ballot box, which is what everybody would like, or it comes out of the barrel of a gun is a question I can't answer at this point. Because whenever I talk to my friends in Germany, they tell me everything is rigged against change. There's no possibility of the Alternative für Deutschland to join the government and come into power. And frankly speaking, AfD is too moderate for what needs to happen in Germany. I think the situation is not very different in France, Italy, and so forth in that sense politically. So an awful lot of what you're discussing right now, I think, really hinges more on our internal conditions than it does on any external interests. I mean, let's be frank. If we were to spiral overnight into a major financial crisis, which could easily happen in the United States, I mean, it's one of these things we talk about, the black swan, and Nassim Taleb wrote this brilliant book, and he coined this term black swan, which means, you know, the thing that nobody wants to happen, that everybody believes will never happen, happens. And
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit again. This is Colonel Douglas McGregor on the Professor Glenn Deason Show. And as a reminder, there are quite a bit of those millions of refugees are because of U.S. and Western wars in the Mideast and the Mediterranean. So got to look behind the immediate problem of why all these people are being driven out of their homes. Don?
As well as climate change. In terms of Syria, they've had a huge increase in over the last few years, and the temperature has made it harder and harder to grow enough crops for people to live there. And it's one of the things which is propelling people out of the out of that area and into other areas that people leave to survive. And the Syrians and the people from Somalia are the ones that have just lost their temporary ability to stay in the U.S. And depending on whatever Trump is going to do, may be sent back to places that may be extremely hard to live in.
And I'm going to come back later to sanction as another key element, even more deadly than wars, has been a big part of U.S. policy for quite some time. Here's a few more minutes from Colonel Douglas McGregor.
Well, looking for a compulsor to make this, but one of the problems of, and this is a problem the Europeans have as well, is not, you know, accepting the current international distribution of power is, well, essentially the system punishes you. And I think a key problem for the U.S. was by still trying to have, you know, global primacy be everywhere at the same time. So prioritize everything, which means prioritizing nothing. It seems that this is causing a lot of problems. I used the example that, you know, for example, the United States pumped in a lot of its weapons to Ukraine. Then it became time to fight Iran. It didn't have enough weapons, so it began to direct them out of East Asia from places like South Korea, took them from Europe, from Ukraine. And then even when it reached the Middle East, it couldn't really protect the Gulf states, also partly because Israel was prioritized. Anyways, my point is, by not prioritizing one region over another, we now see that, well, essentially key allies from Europe to the Gulf states to East Asia are now discussing to what extent they should develop their own capabilities and, you know, whether or not they can rely on the partnership with the U.S. I think this could have been avoided if the U.S. had just said, you know, our resources are limited, let's focus on this or in that region, and but it hasn't. So I guess my question is, how do you see the alliance system which the U.S. has built up? How long can this be sustained unless the U.S. Begins to, well, not necessarily scale back, but prioritize some regions over the other, or at least act according to limited resources? Again, as I would add, at least the Americans have resources, the Europeans do not, and they still act as if they have plentiful. So,
well, you're talking correctly and accurately about this ends means calculus. that hasn't been done in the United States for decades. There was always this assumption of limitless resources, limitless money. Remember, all of this begins with the end of the gold standard. Once you were no longer tied to the gold standard, you could print as much money as you wanted. And that's exactly what we've done. And so instead of trying to maintain a solvent household, we've simply printed more money, brought it up from the basement and say, here you go. We'll pay for it with this. And with each passing year, obviously the currency has been worth less. Now we have an inflation problem. Some people think we're going to have a deflation problem as well. Whatever happens, we know two things. Number one, we're headed into a very serious recession. There are very few people who deny that. Secondly, it could easily become a depression. The longer this business in the Gulf continues, the more likely we are to see a global depression. We'll see famine. We'll see shortages of all types and kinds and minerals and products and technologies, all because of this crazy, unnecessary war in the Persian Gulf. What will happen? I think you will see, excuse me, I think what you're going to see is it doesn't make any difference what happens over the next 6 months. The future is pretty clear. We are going to have to withdraw most of our forces from beyond our borders. We are going to have to cut defense spending. Defense spending is the largest portion of what we call discretionary spending. We're talking about a budget this coming year of $1.5 trillion. It's absurd. It's fantasy world. We can't afford the trillion that we're wasting now. We're going to have to make some hard decisions. The good news is the whole foundation, the rationale for the NATO alliance and our other alliances around the world are no longer valid. There was a wonderful op-ed that was penned in a Korean newspaper. I read it this morning. I'll send it to you. It was translated into English. And this Korean journalist very astutely and very, very calmly pointed out that warfare has changed. He looked at the Persian Gulf. He looked at what's going on in Ukraine. And he says, if you have U.S. forces stationed on your soil and the United States decides to go to war with China, with Russia, with Iran, with anybody, those forces on your soil are now magnets for enemy action. In other words, they're now part of the problem. They're not a source of security. They are a source of insecurity. Here's Korea, a nation of almost 50 million. It's a brilliant society with a brilliant economy, and it's quite prepared to defend itself and navigate the waters of the international ocean as a sovereign state. And we keep insisting that they retain our military establishment on their soil. They don't want it. They haven't wanted it for a long time. They don't need it, and now they see it as a liability, not an asset. The Japanese will reach similar conclusions. The Europeans will reach similar conclusions. And the thing that people really need to understand, and they haven't grasped this yet, everybody talks about Finland's magnificent and courageous stand against the Soviets in 1939. Well, they need to look at what has happened in Iran. Iran has conquered the revolution in military affairs for the present. And that revolution, which began back in the mid-20th century, is to link overhead surveillance of all kinds, whether it's a Reaper or it's a satellite, any number of different things, a manned or unmanned aircraft. Link that intelligence surveillance reconnaissance platform and the data for targeting that it produces directly to ground stations that control thousands of platforms with hundreds of different strike systems.
There again, that's Colonel Douglas McGregor getting into some of the changed military landscape as well as the global relations landscape on the part of Europe, Korea, Japan, what have you. I want to add that McGregor feels like there is a serious likelihood of U.S. and Israel once again escalating and attacking Iran. After this 60 days, or perhaps longer than the current 60 days, we're now into about 40-some days left. But another of our occasional commentators, Scott Ritter, strongly disagrees with this perspective outlook on the likelihood of war. I'm not going to play his comments, but I want to make clear that not everyone agrees that escalation is likely, even though it's an obvious risk. According to Ritter, Trump is actually impotent regarding Iran, and he will have to de-escalate the too many risk factors, economic and military and otherwise. And he adds an important point that I haven't heard from anyone else, that Iran eventually will have to relent on some of its demands and learn to live with its neighbors. International law is still in place, despite frequent violations all over the globe, and it's an important factor in a long-term ability for the Persian Gulf nations and Iran to get along. I want to go into a few minutes of a kind of homework here, because you hear a lot about the petrodollar, and I got a good passage that explains just what that is, because one of the things going on now is the world is trying to establish trade outside the dollar and is gradually succeeding in this effort, which is reducing the demand for U.S. dollars. Iran, a major oil producer, has threatened the petrodollar dominance and has been under sanctions attack by the U.S. and the West since 1979, its revolution. So what is the petrodollar? Some historical background. By the way, this also summarizes the economic dynamic Michael Hudson explored in his pioneering book, Super Imperialism, and in subsequent books by Michael Hudson. Okay, several points here on the petrodollar. In 1974-1975, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia reached an understanding. Saudi Arabia would price all its oil exports in U.S. dollars and invest its surplus oil revenues in U.S. Treasury securities. I want to point out right away, this is far beyond getting off the gold standard, which McGregor and others place so much importance on. This is having to do with the petro trade. In return, the United States offered military protection, arms sales, and technical support to the Saudi regime. Other OPEC nations gradually followed suit, making the dollar the dominant currency for global oil trade. The system created several massive advantages for the United States. Constant global demand for dollars. Every country that imports oil must hold or acquire U.S. dollars. Lower borrowing costs. High demand for treasuries allows the U.S. to finance large deficits at relatively low interest rates. Exorbitant privilege, a phrase that Charles de Gaulle used. The U.S. can print dollars to pay for imports, including oil, while the rest of the world holds those dollars as reserves and funds our wars and other adventures. Geopolitical leverage. Control over the dollar-based oil trade gives Washington enormous influence over global energy flows and sanctions power. For decades, this system helped the U.S. maintain its economic supremacy even as its share of global GDP declined. Comments from Gail Tverberg at Our Finite World on the above petrodollar points. I see this ability to always import more than we export as a way of raising the standard of living of the U.S. relative to other countries. If U.S. hegemony goes away, we will lose this. It is U.S. hegemony that gives us this power, in my opinion, but we are on the edge of losing such hegemony with or without the petrodollar arrangement. The U.S. has shown that it cannot protect the trade of oil suppliers. The impact has not yet fully been reflected in the system. Trump and Vance are trying their best to push this day off into the future. Later, again, I'm going to return to the sanctions aspect of dollar dominance. And for those who want to pursue this, there's a one-hour-plus discussion on the Democracy at Work site with Professor Richard Wolf and Yanis Varoufakis, former Greek finance minister. That's at the Democracy at Work site. Based on Wall Street Journal report on Saudi Arabia, They're moving away from U.S. and toward Pakistan. Here's a brief passage from recent Wall Street Journal. The U.S. never relaunched Project Freedom. This was a proposed alliance with Saudi Arabia. It moved ships out of the Gulf at night with transponders off. The coercive escort strategy failed and reverted to evasion. For 80 years, the deal was simple. Saudi Arabia provides basing, oil priced in dollars, and alignment. The U.S. provides protection. The long grand bargain between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is ending, and the Gulf is splitting. And here's a paragraph of the New York Times of just a couple of days ago, including comments from a Mr. Campbell, former Deputy Secretary of State. The biggest question now is how long the crisis persists. Mr. Campbell said the impact on many countries and supply chains had been, quote, deep and profound, and could worsen if the crisis continues. Japan, South Korea, and others have worked through many of the reserves that have so far buffered them from the economic effects. In many capacities, from jet fuel to a lot of diesel oils, we are basically almost running on empty, said Mr. Campbell. And a couple of humorous notes to close out the bit about Iran and talk some more about Israel. But one wag said that since the Memorandum of Understanding was clearly a kind of surrender document on the U.S. part, at least if it fulfills it, which it may or may not do, Trump's famous book, The Art of the Deal, was actually not exactly manifested in this Memorandum of Understanding in Versailles, signed there of all places. It was a kind of Hail Mary desperation pass by Trump. So the joke I read was Ayatollah Khomeini has a new book, The Art of the Deal. And the first rule is always negotiate with a moron. And just for those, again, who want to pursue something pretty funny and pretty brilliant, as you may have heard, Iran has been putting out extremely clever and hip, fast-moving Lego-based satires on U.S. Activities. Very current, very well-informed, and you can find them on YouTube under Pros in Panic. And the latest one is titled, Donnie, Who's the Idiot Now? So I have some things on Israel, a couple comments, and then we'll get into Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who has some really good comments. Just to remind people that the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, is an extremely important piece of legislation. It may or may not pass Congress, but it has the astounding surrender of U.S. sovereignty to Israel baked right into it. Under the new agreement, the U.S. will have to share its secrets with Israel, but Israel won't be obliged to share anything with the U.S. If the U.S. doesn't get its dog leashed, Iran will force it to relent. In the U.S., pro-Israel candidates are losing in New York City and Colorado. The winners oppose AIPAC money and the Israel war. In an important Michigan Senate race is next in this drama. Don, you have anything?
Well, you know, it's...
In the 1990s, though, it...
Sorry, that's the next tape.
It's interesting...
This Greater Israel...
That people can be members of both the Israeli armed forces as well as the U.S. armed forces. It's... special circumstance which they have allowed, and it goes on, so it's well established.
All right, I have Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who's director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. He has a great deal of international experience, Europe, and testified many times before the United Nations. He's being interviewed on the Glenn Deason Show. And let's see if I can find the right spot here.
project. It had a good fighting store, U.S. hegemony, but also Israeli supremacy in the region. But given the defeat there now, which doesn't only change the distribution of power, but also the United States, we see more distancing itself from Israel, not by everyone, of course, but groups which didn't utter this in the open in the past. I was just wondering, as a brief question, what will be this impact then on the greater Israel project? I mean, what are Israel's strategic options now?
I sincerely hope the idea of greater Israel is finished, period. That's my own hope. It's a disgusting idea. There are 8 million Palestinian Arabs, and there is absolutely no cause for genocide or ethnic cleansing or apartheid rule. And there needs to be a solution. And for many people, and it's quite plausible and natural, there should be one state, democratic and binational. And there are many examples of that. I could take Belgium as an example of the Walloons and the Flemish. They haven't always gotten along. There are deep cultural and sectarian and historical differences, but they make two states, by the way. They actually have five parliaments in Belgium to handle all of the different complexities of the multi-ethnicities. So Israel could become one state, a binational state, or what has been the international law and the intention of the UN General Assembly for, I would say, all the period since 1947, and then especially after 1967 again, two states, a Palestinian state and a state living side by side. Many people say that's now passé. I don't know what's passé. Either solution is possible. What is not possible, in my view, is an apartheid state or continued reckless murder by Israel, whether in Gaza or in the West Bank. And the violence in the West Bank every day is shocking. Israeli settlers dragging Palestinians out, killing them, expropriating their land, burning houses. It's just got to stop this absolutely inhuman behavior and this intergroup hatred and this Jewish power, which is actually the name of one of the political parties that is governing Israel right now, that kind of supremacist idea. It's just got to stop. There are two basic reasons why it may be coming to an end right now. And you emphasized one of them, very important. The United States and Israel cannot impose this solution on the region. They thought, well, Israel's invaded Lebanon in the past. It's weakened Hezbollah. Syria has been overthrown. The Iranian reach has been brought down. Hamas has been weakened, if not defeated, by the Gaza war and the Gaza genocide. So one view says that, okay, we're close. All we have to do is overthrow the Iranian regime. Turned out this was delusional. By the way, if they had asked you or they had asked me on February 28th, we would have told them that it was delusional. But they went ahead thinking this would be a one-day war. And it proved not only not a one-day war, but Iran is a sophisticated country, a large country of more than 90 million people. It's got hypersonic missiles. It's got space technology. It's got advanced drone technology. And it has the capacity to destroy a lot of the neighborhood. So it has a deterrent capacity, which it demonstrated, which is why there is this fragile, nascent agreement, because Iran closed the straits, demonstrated military deterrence. The U.S. had no military option that would have been able to avoid a destruction of the Gulf region and the world economy. So in the end, Trump said, okay, we stop this. And that's what this agreement is about. And I agree with Trump on this. Of course, I disagree with him on having started this war, which is fatuous. But I agree with him on ending the war, because What are you going to do? Nothing else. This really is a stalemate. So that's one reason why this Greater Israel project, I hope, is on its last legs. But the other is internal to the United States, and that is that the U.S. has been essentially the backstop of the Greater Israel project. Europe, for many reasons, does Israel's bidding to an extent, but there's much, much less backing. And the U.S. has backed it because the power of the Zionist lobby has been great, and it's been a kind of dual lobby. One is the American Jews and their relations with Israeli Jews and promoting this cause. And the second has been the Christian Zionists like Huckabee. And that's been a formidable lobby in the United States for 30 years. But what's happened, Glenn, is that with the genocide in Gaza, people watching this every day, people coming to understand, what is this about? And why isn't there a state of Palestine alongside a state of Israel? Why isn't there some solution to this? And hearing that the Arabs are saying, yes, we would have peace and normal relations if there's a state of Palestine, their peace initiative, Americans have come to understand something is really wrong with this picture. And so in just 3 years, American public opinion has swung from support of Israel to support of the Palestinian people. And the view of Israel is hugely negative. And the attitude towards the war in Iran is devastatingly negative. Americans hated the war. They hated the war because it was useless, it was expensive, and it raised their gasoline prices. And it was cruel, killing 160 schoolgirls on the first day because Palantir couldn't get its targeting right. Come on. So the American people were completely disgusted by this. And Trump is also looking at this, and he's facing an election in early November. And what happened, Glenn, in my city, in New York City, a couple of days ago, is absolutely amazing. New York City is the greatest concentration of Jews, American Jews. It's a very Jewish, it's not a Jewish city, but it's got a very strong Jewish population. And the voters of New York voted for the anti-Greater Israel candidates. We had one congressional primary election, two Jews running against each other. One was his current congressman who supported the normal, we love Israel, we support what Israel does. And the other, a city councilman, who said, I'm running against what Israel's extremism, and I'm running against my candidate who is for it. So anybody that says this has to do with anti-Semitism or something else knows nothing. This was two Jews running against each other, and the anti-Israel candidate won in a landslide. And then there were two other congressional races, basically, that weren't two Jews running against each other, but not even Jewish candidates. But in fact, the candidates that said, we stand with the Palestinian people, won decisive victories. That's New York City. This is happening across the United States. I keep telling, I've said it from the first days of Israel's war in Gaza, and I've said it to the Israeli ambassador to the UN, and I've said it as many times as possible. Israel is losing its only support because of its extremism. Americans would support Israel, but they do not support Greater Israel.
There again, Professor Jeffrey Sachs on the Glenn Decent program, and always a very articulate summary can be counted on from him. Now, we've only got a few minutes left, but I've got two things. I can't do both of them. I've been promising some comments on sanctions because I don't think people realize the powerful and deadly effect of U.S. sanctions, far greater than our wars in terms of human suffering and death. And also, I'm going to have to put off once again a brilliant passage by Larry Johnson, former CIA officer, that has some explanation of this term terrorism. Here's a brief example. Britain has invaded 171 countries. France has murdered 22 African presidents since 1963. The U.S. runs 750 military bases in 80 nations. And you're worried about Russia? And Donald recalled that after 2021, all the stories on Ukraine Nazis disappeared from the Western press. All of a sudden, they were, you know, the democratic outpost in Europe, whereas they have a very strong, and in continuing today, strong history of Nazi affiliation. But let me take a few minutes about sanctions. I know we don't have much time, but this is really important to me, personally important that people understand what some of our lifestyle is based on. And a study in 2025 in the Lancet Global Health, a prestigious medical journal, which gives us a global view for the first time of the impact of sanctions, led by an economist at the University of Denver, Francisco Rodriguez, and covers sanctions from 1970 to 2021, almost entirely U.S. and European sanctions. The results are staggering. The authors find that unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. and EU since 1970 are associated with 38 million deaths. In some years during the 1990s, more than a million people were killed. In 2021, the most recent year of data, sanctions caused more than 800,000 deaths. This is denying medicine, food, and fuel as a result of our dollar dominance, which we talked about earlier, and another reason why the world is determined to get away from this. According to these results, several times more people are killed by sanctions each year than are killed in as direct casualties of war. More than half of the victims are children and the elderly, people who are most vulnerable to malnutrition. The study finds that since 2012 alone, sanctions have killed more than 1 million children. This goes on in Cuba, too. State Department in Malmo in April 1960 explains the purpose of U.S. sanctions against Cuba, noted that Castro and the revolutionary more broadly enjoyed widespread popularity. It argued that, quote, every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba by denying money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government. So this is our sanctions policy that so many deaths are resulting.
It's something that people don't realize that supposedly is the the humanitarian way of showing discontent or disregard for other countries. But just because people are not killed with bullets and bombs doesn't mean that it doesn't have a very deleterious effect on their society.
One more paragraph. This is from Jackson Hinkle, a very good commentator. You can find him online. The power of Western sanctions hinges on their control over the world's reserve currency, the U.S. dollar and the euro, their control over international payment systems, that's SWIFT, and their monopoly over essential technologies, for example, satellites, cloud computation, and software. If countries in the global south wish to chart a more independent path towards a multipolar world, they will need to take steps to limit their dependence in these respects and thus insulate themselves from backlash. The recent experience of Russia shows that such an approach can succeed.
So we have just about a minute left. Maybe sometime in the future I'm going to talk about leading up to World War One, the way the European powers carved up Africa, because that was one of the things that also led to the World War One, which is rarely talked about anymore.
Carved up the Middle East because they knew by then already that they were going to need the oil. So most of these countries are completely fabricated in the 100-year-old period.
Well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with Dave Gudnick and Don Olson. And coming up will be Global Beat with a new DJ today. We'll soon find out.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
The Minnesota
Minnesota tradition of heading up to the lake for the weekend often means listening to the sounds of water skiers. Yet there was a time when skiing was a sport confined to the snow. Here's Kate Roberts from the Minnesota Historical Society.
Ralph Samuelson was an 18-year-old who became somewhat obsessed with trying to figure out how to ski on water. He tried snow skis, he tried barrel staves, wasn't working. Well, then he went to the lumber company, probably, and got himself some 8-foot-long boards, 9 inches wide, steamed the ends of them with his mom's copper kettle, and fashioned what he thought would